Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we're very blessed to have with us David Seeloff, and he has graciously agreed to do Part B of Where is the Lake of Fire? And we left off in our last audio file, which was 22A. We were talking about Appendix 5 in 101 Bible Secrets, Where is the Lake of Fire? Today we will continue this topic, and this is file 22B, as in boy. And David Seeloff is the director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge. And you can email David at this address, david@askelm.com. Go to the website, askelm.com. And you can read this book, 101 Bible Secrets, for free online, right there at askelm.com. And this is a fascinating book that we're going through. Hi, David.
Hi, Georgianne. Good to finish up here on the appendix number 5, Where is the Lake of Fire?
Right.
And, of course, in part 1, just as a quick recap, we're going through the text of Dr. Martin's book, 101 Bible Secrets, and we covered the information that the Lake of Fire is the Dead Sea.
Yes.
And that it's related in prophecy and history to the chasm of the Jordan River, the Trans-Jordan Fault, and also is connected with the Valley of Hinnom that comes from Jerusalem down to the Dead Sea and will reactivate at some time in the future, actually just before the second coming of Christ. So continuing on with the aspect of the scapegoat, which was placed in the Valley of Hinnom, which is also known as Gehenna, that Jesus talks about and is well known to all the Jews of the period. But the Valley of Hinnom, Dr. Martin continues where we left off,
okay,
the place of the scapegoat, that no one, as Dr. Martin says, no one can adequately grasp the typical teaching about Gehenna, the abyss, the bottomless pit, and the lake of fire, which were intimately connected, without realizing what the area is like in which the scapegoat was taken and released. The geographical name of this region is the Wilderness of Judea. It's one of the most unique areas on earth, and that wilderness is an utter desert of the worst kind, and yet it was right next door to the region of, quote, olive oil and honey, a land wherein you shall eat bread without scarceness, and you shall not lack anything in it. And this is from Deuteronomy chapter 8, verses 8 to 9, where that Moses wrote just before the people entered the land. So that's what the land was on the west side, and then you go into the wilderness, and, you know, the margin between a comparative paradise of green and the utter desolation of brown, much like where you live, Georgianne, near Vegas.
Yeah, it's just a wasteland with neon signs.
So the margin between paradise and utter desolation is often no more than 1, 2, or 3 miles.
Yeah.
Sometimes very just the other side of a hill sometimes.
Can I ask a question, David?
With yeah.
Putting the sins on the scapegoat, was this to alleviate the people of taking responsibility for their sins?
No, it symbolically did clear the sins for the people for a year. But, of course, individually, you know, people had to do that by themselves. And this is all symbol. It was all leading to Christ. So that the only sacrifice that was ever truly efficacious,
yes,
was Christ's sacrifice.
Right.
All the others were pointing to that. So, you know, these are all different kinds of symbols.
Okay, now
the sin offering, the scapegoat, the red heifer offering, all of these are just pointing to Christ.
Is that also because people are just kind of too dense to get it? I mean, you know, there's no real spiritual maturity?
Well,
or what?
No, not necessarily. The book of Hebrews says that, you know, the blood of bulls and goats can't really take away sin.
Right.
It's just a picture. So, you know, it's just a representation, a temporary mediator, just like the priests were mediators between man and God. But even they were just temporary
mm-hmm.
until Christ came, who now can effectively mediate between man and God.
Okay.
And so that's my answer to that.
Okay.
You know, people who travel to the area of the Valley of Hinnom down toward the area of the wilderness are actually quite amazed at the abrupt contrast. And George Adam Smith, who wrote the classic book called The Historical Geography of the Holy Land, he gave some graphic descriptions of this wasteland to the east of Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Martin says, though he's seen it himself many times, the words of a professional geographer cannot be surpassed for description. And he says, note what Professor Smith has to say about this land of the scapegoat, where, by the way, Christ was tempted by Satan the devil.
Right.
At the temptation. George Adam Smith says, quote, the wilderness of Judea, in the Old Testament, this land is called Jeshimon, a word meaning devastation. This is in page 211 of Smith's book.
Mm-hmm.
It is one of the driest and most poisoned regions on our planet, page 183. Those 15 miles of chaos east of Jerusalem, sinking downward to a stretch of the Dead Sea, show the influence of the desert on Jewish imagination and literature. It gave the ancient people of Judea the sense of living next door to doom, the sense of how narrow is the border between life and death, the awe of the power of God, who can make contiguous areas so opposite in character. Page 212. For hours, as you travel across these hills, you may feel no sign of life, except the scorpions and vipers, which your passage startles. In the distance, a few wild goats or gazelles, and at night, the wailing of a jackal and the hyena's howl. This is on page 213. From the heart of the country, near Jerusalem, the wilderness of Judea carries violence and desolation right down to the same desolation of the Dead Sea Valley, page 211. And there could hardly be an area more foreboding and awesomely stark on the surface of this earth, end quote. It's actually worse than Death Valley in California.
Mm-hmm.
If you know, not everyone's traveled to Israel, but a lot more people perhaps have traveled to Death Valley in that area. What is so striking in Israel is Israel is kind of like California, but it's so much more compact and smaller. And so that the contrasts are so very much more striking. You have a beautiful and well-watered land on the west side with the crests of the Holy Land, and then, so quickly and abruptly, the thorough devastation and desolation of the land of the scapegoat, the region traversed by Gehenna, which is also called the stream bed of fire, the location of the abyss, or the bottomless pit, and then the Dead Sea itself, which is the lake of fire. So that there's a continuation of symbol as well as a reality from the Valley of Hinnom, Gehenna, down through to the Lake of Fire. This is the very region where Christ battled Satan for 40 days and won. But this is also where Satan will be bound, the area of the scapegoat, for 1,000 years. And this is in Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 to 3. There could be no harsher area for confinement. And this is the region of the abyss, the bottomless pit, of the book of Revelation. The abyss into which Satan is shut up is not the lake of fire. You have to keep those things distinguished. He is only placed in the abyss for 1,000 years. It is after the millennium that Satan is cast into the lake of fire that burns with fire and brimstone, which is the Dead Sea. And this is in Revelation chapter 20, verse 10.
What is it in Revelation, David, where it says, and the angel that has the key to the abyss? What is that about?
Well, let's look at that here.
Yeah, because that's kind of interesting. If it's a desert region...
Yeah, that's in Revelation chapter 20 and verse 1.
Okay.
I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold of the dragon, on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the text makes a very point, a very definite point of identifying who this creature is that's being laid hold of. I mean, it's a fourfold identification. Dragon, serpent, devil, and Satan.
Yeah.
You know,
uh-huh.
So that there's no doubt as to who we're talking about. He lays hold on him and bound him for 1,000 years and cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal upon him that he should deceive the nations no more till 1,000 years should be fulfilled. And after that, he is loosed a little season.
Yeah.
So that's in Revelation. Now,
what does that mean in light of what we're talking about?
Well, he's going to be there for the millennium.
But
in
I mean,
the abyss.
Is the bottomless pit?
It's on the way to from Gehenna to the Dead Sea.
Okay.
Remember years ago when Bishop James Pike went missing? He
yes.
went down that pathway. He
huh.
went from he was on his way down the Valley of Hinnom down into toward the Dead Sea. His body's never been found to this day, but a lot of people supposedly have talked to him as a spirit, but it's just a demonic spirit portraying him.
Yes.
But this is the area in which he went, and it's so stark and such a terrible... He must have fallen into a crevasse somewhere, and they've yet to find his body. And this
oh,
was in the
goodness.
70s or 60s when he disappeared.
Oh, my gosh.
And now, that was verses 1 to 3 of Revelation 20. In verse 10 of Revelation 20, it says that... Remember it says in verse 3 that he'll be loosed for a season?
Right.
Okay. Now in verse 10, you know, where is it here? Here it is. Okay. In verse 10 it says, and the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and the false prophet were put. It says in the King James, are, but the word are isn't in the Greek. And he shall be tormented day and night for the age of the ages, which is the age after the millennium, actually. Here, let me scroll up here. Yeah, for the aeons of the aeons. So, after the millennium, Satan will be then cast into the, you know, he's going out of the frying pan into the fire, from the abyss into the lake of fire, although as a spirit being, it won't affect him, but it'll, and everyone will be able to look at him.
Oh my
gosh. Him.
Oh. Gosh.
Like a zoo.
Yeah. I wonder, you know, when it says the beast, can we understand that to also mean the system of the beast?
I don't think so. I think in this case, in verse 10, I think it means the spirit being.
Okay.
Who possesses the false prophet.
Okay.
It's called the beast.
Okay.
Or the beast is the spirit who possesses the, perhaps the Antichrist. And, you know, it's a little murky.
Yeah.
Human beings don't survive the lake of fire.
Right.
They die. Their flesh, you know, goes off. And, but it says the beast and the false prophet are there also. This tells me that they're not human. At least this part of them wasn't human. It's probably a possession. These are the entities who possessed the human beings who were also the beast and the false prophet. So, you know, it's a populated air. It's a populated universe, creation that God made.
Oh, yeah.
There's all sorts of bad guys out there. It's not just Satan and his angels.
Yeah. We have a lot of them at the FDA right now, too. Yeah, we do. I'm sorry, David. I this is a very serious subject, but I just had to say that.
So Satan will be kept in a deep pit, a prison, east of Jerusalem, between Beth Chaduda and the Dead Sea, within the region of the Valley of Fire, the eastern parts of Gehenna. In a book written about 100 years before the birth of Christ and attributed to Enoch, we have more information about these matters as understood by Jewish people who lived at that time. Now, this book of Enoch is not a canonical book of the Bible, but it was referred to by Jude in verses 14 and 15 of his epistle. Now, it describes a great deal of information that is very compatible with teachings found in the book of Revelation. And also, it's important to note that the author of the book of Enoch was an eyewitness. Now, there's a sliding scale of things in apocryphal books that I'm going off text here for a moment. In my understanding, there's a sliding scale of reliability. When an author in an apocryphal book talks about something that he has witnessed, not in vision, but as an eyewitness, and this applies to Josephus or any other non-biblical writing, if they're an eyewitness and they're reporting what they're seeing, they're very reliable. Not equal to Scripture even then, but they're very, pretty much reliable at that point. This applies to the book of Maccabees also.
Yeah.
Now, when they're working from documents, then that's a lesser state, and it depends on how close the documents are to their time period. Josephus had access to the documents of the court records of King Herod. So I would say that they're probably reliable in so much as you getting King Herod's court-appointed historian's point of view of things. But events are probably fairly accurate. Then you have things, dreams and visions, like the Book of Enoch, the portions of the Book of Enoch, which, you know, they're not as reliable as the visions in Scripture, which are totally reliable. And then you also have to figure in the symbolism, whether it's symbolic or real. Sometimes it's both, at least in the Scripture. Then you have, and that's less reliable, and then you have other statements, like you have statements of outright channeled material and demons, like some of the apocryphal books are.
Yeah.
And, most of that stuff, in my opinion, the Book of Mormon was a channel document, and
yes,
the Osafi book and the Urantia book. And I wouldn't, I don't even waste my time with that kind of stuff because, for me, why bother?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of other stuff like that. So that a lot of this material, is on a sliding scale of reliability. And sometimes within a few passages, you shift from eyewitness to visionary material.
Yeah.
You shift from good stuff to questionable at best. So that's just an aside. Now I'm going to go back to the text about the Book of Enoch. The Book of Enoch describes a great deal of information that is compatible with teachings found in the Book of Revelation, although Revelation is the standard. The book gives much typical teaching about Gehenna, the abyss, and the lake of fire, as believed in many Jewish quarters in the time of Christ. And in this book, the ancient Enoch was supposed to have seen in vision the manner in which God would judge wicked angels, or evil angels, and wicked men. In Enoch 54, verse 1, he, quote, sees a deep valley with burning fire, end quote. This is the stream bed of Gehenna, as it leaves Jerusalem for its eastward track to the wilderness of Judea and the Dead Sea. As they say, it's all downhill from there.
Yeah.
Once a person starts down the stream bed from Jerusalem, he gets closer to the wilderness. He then comes in contact with the kings. This is Enoch in vision. Comes in contact with the kings and the mighty, in other words, the angelic powers in confinement, mentioned in Isaiah chapter 24, verses 21 and 22. And this is the place of the pit, or the abyss. And it and these are spiritual, angelic powers, who are also termed kings and mighty, of course, in Scripture. It answers to the Beth Chaduda, the house of Chaduda, region where the scapegoat, the Azazel goat, is cast into the abyss down a steep and precipitous cliff. He's not thrown down. He's allowed to climb down. The Book of Enoch says this is where, quote, iron chains are placed upon those who descend into its bosom, end quote, meaning the bosom of the abyss. And this is the place or places where the evil angels are going to be temporarily confined.
Now, this is someplace underground, right?
Yes, yes.
Deep underground.
No, we don't know. They're locked in. We know that.
Wow.
And because Peter talks about that. They're kept in chains underground. Quote, in Enoch 45, verse 5, quote, these are being prepared for the hosts of Azazel, so that they may take them and cast them into the abyss, the bottomless pit.
Well, Azazel is another ancient word for Satan, isn't it?
I'm not so sure. It probably is identified in some places. Enoch does, probably,
okay,
identify him. I don't want to say. I'd have to look it up, frankly.
Okay. But David, if these are spirit beings, powers, how would chains hold them?
Well, there's some type of chains that work. I don't know. Spiritual chains. That's actually what Peter talks about.
I need that information right now. I do.
Let me look it up there. Well, let me see here. Try something else here.
Okay. That's interesting how chains, you know, they've got to be some very, they must be very special chains.
Oh, yeah. Come on. Okay. 2 Peter, chapter 2, verse 4. For if God spared not sinning messengers, but thrust them, for if God spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down to Tartarus, to hell, which in this case, it's the only instance of the word Tartarus, which is Tartarus,
yeah,
which was immediately identifiable to Greeks and Hellenists, of course, as being the place where the Titans were kept in prison. So Peter chooses to use that term. They were cast down into hell and delivered into chains of darkness to be reserved into judgment. Now, the word chains chains of... Let me see here. Now, another translation has gloomy caverns of Tartarus. And that the word chains isn't really used. So, in other words, they're being kept, reserved, and...
held in detention, as it were.
Yeah. The word chains doesn't really exist in the Greek, apparently.
Okay.
That's interesting. I had never noticed that before. Caverns of gloom is what one translation has, or... thick gloom. Well, chains is into gloomy cavern. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
In any case, they're still there.
Okay.
Yeah. And the Book of Enoch confirms that, but not that Scripture needs confirm. Peter confirms what the Book of Enoch is saying. And it's probably from Enoch that the King James took the word chains. This is the place or places where the evil angels are going to be temporarily confined. Quote, and God will imprison those angels who have shown unrighteousness in that burning valley, that is the eastern parts of Gehenna, the Wadi Etnar, in the mountains of Israel, end quote. This is the very place where the scapegoat, the Azazel goat, was taken in ritual, in the ritual of the Day of Atonement. As said before, this was in an area down the Wadi Adnar. A wadi is a valley, a river valley, like a...
Yeah.
What do they call them in the Southwest?
Gullies.
Gullies, yeah. Washes. Yeah. That's a wadi, is similar to a gully or a wash. East of Beth Jaduda, about 3 miles eastward of Jerusalem. And you can see the early Jewish work in the Mishnah called the Yoma 6.8. The Book of Enoch goes on to say that it is the same place where a, quote, star had fallen from heaven into the abyss, and now that abyss, the bottomless pit, was narrow and deep and horrible and dark. And this is in Enoch chapter 88, verses 1 and 2. The Apostle John in the book of Revelation spoke of the same place. Quote, I saw a star falling from heaven into the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pit, the abyss. And he opens the bottomless pit, and there arose smoke out of the pit as the smoke of a great furnace. And this is in Revelation chapter 9, verses 1 and 2. The book of Enoch also said that the archangels will take hold of Azazel, the scapegoat, with his angels and, quote, cast them into the burning furnace, end quote. Enoch chapter 54, verse 6. Now, the book of Enoch, as does the book of Revelation, recognizes the abyss as a temporary place of punishment only. Professor R.H. Charles, who translated the book of Enoch and is kind of the standard work on, standard translation on the apocryphal and pseudepigraphal books, he said that this prison is the burning valley, Gehenna, and that this is the preliminary prison and not the final prison. This is in Pseudepigrapha, Volume 2, page 231. John in Revelation said the same thing. Satan is placed in the abyss for 1,000 years. He is only placed in the lake of fire after the millennium is over. So the lake of fire is different than the abyss. And this is in Revelation 20, verses 1 to 10, for the whole context.
David, gosh, unless it's a spiritual fire, how would it destroy the spirit of something?
Well, it doesn't. They're imprisoned there.
Yeah.
The lake of fire for a spirit being is a prison. It's not a, it doesn't burn them up.
It just holds them.
Right.
Okay.
Just holds them. Before, the typical location of this abyss is where the scapegoat was taken a few miles east of Jerusalem down the Valley of Fire, the eastern extension of Gehenna. This abyss was somehow supposed to be connected to the lowest waters, quote, under the earth, and end quote, and sometimes those waters were considered hot and boiling. This was where the angels and Satan are to be bound. These are the entities that the Apostle Paul refers to when he spoke about those, quote, under the earth, end quote, in Philippians chapter 2 and verse 10. The Apostle Peter said that angels had been placed there as early as the flood of Noah, and this is in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 19 and 20. Christ even went to preach to those angels in that prison after his resurrection from the dead. But as was said before, the abyss is not the final place of punishment for the rebellious. That last place is the lake of fire. That lake is located on down the mountain from the abyss, just east of the Beth Chaduda. It descends further to the lower habitable, to the lowest habitable spot on earth. This is the Dead Sea, which is also the lake of fire. The Book of Enoch calls this area the Valley of the Angels who led astray mankind, burned beneath that land, end quote. Enoch 67, verse 7. This is the reference to the Jordan Rift Valley in which the Dead Sea was located. This is the area mentioned by Jude, set forth as an example of age-lasting fire in Jude 7. The depths of Tartarus, where the evil angels were kept, was somehow connected with these judgment waters of the Dead Sea. Now, into these depths will flow, quote, streams of fire, end quote, according to the Book of Enoch in 67, verse 7. Now, remarkably, there is a prophecy of the future connected with Christ's second coming that says all the stream beds of the country of Edom, which is the southeastern watershed of the Dead Sea area. In other words, if it would ever rain in the southeast area of the Dead Sea, to the east of the lake of the Dead Sea, all those water courses will, at one time, just before Christ returns, be filled with fire and burning pitch. Quote, for it is the day of the Lord's vengeance and the year of recompenses for the controversy of Zion. And the streams shall be turned into pitch and the dust into brimstone, and the land, meaning the land of Edom, shall become burning pitch, and it shall not be quenched day or night. The smoke shall go up forever, or to the age. From generation to generation it shall lie waste. End quote. Isaiah chapter 34, verses 8 to 10. Now this takes place at the exact time that the heavens depart as a scroll, in Isaiah 34, 4. In other words, the heavens are going to open up, and then the Christ and his angels will return on horses at that time. This is directly quoted in the book of Revelation. And by the way, that's in Isaiah 34, verse 4. This is directly quoted in the book of Revelation as a time associated with Christ's second advent back to earth, in Revelation chapter 6, verses 12 to 14. These several streams of Edom will flow into the Dead Sea. The streams will traverse part of the Valley of Jehoshaphat, called in Joel chapter 3, verses 12 to 14, as the Valley of Decision. This area of the southern portion of the Dead Sea will be the location of the greatest military action in history. The nations of the world will assemble at Armageddon at the Valley of Megiddo, far north of Jerusalem in Galilee. North of Galilee, actually. Or northern.
This, in the timeline, is this after the first resurrection?
Actually, there's an article on this in terms of the time sequence.
Okay.
And this is kind of a preview for that. We could maybe do that after. Christ actually returns,
yeah,
and the dead are risen before the battles are fought, and we get to watch.
Wow.
But we won't participate necessarily. We just apparently will watch.
Okay.
In our resurrected state, because we won't be able to do much.
Yeah.
You know, we're not going to have control of all the powers and things that we'll have. So that's my understanding of that. This area of the southern, well, it'll be the greatest military action in history. The nations of the world will assemble at Armageddon and journey to Jerusalem. Part of the army will go from the north, and another part of the army will go around the Dead Sea and attack Jerusalem from the south. In other words, but they have to go through this Valley of Decision, and they won't make it to Jerusalem. They're going to be attacked by Christ and his host from heaven at the Valley of Decision, at the southern end of the Dead Sea, where Christ will fight them at his second advent. This is the same battle when Gog, the leader of these armies in the Valley of Decision, will have, quote, great hailstones, fire, and brimstone coming down on him and his rebellious army, end quote. Or, quote, great hail, fire, and brimstone, end quote, coming down on him and his rebellious army. The whole countryside near the Dead Sea will once again become a fiery furnace when the judgment of God begins to occur at the coming of Christ back to this earth. Now, the Dead Sea fires will at that time become reactivated. The Dead Sea, east of Jerusalem, is the lake of fire mentioned in the book of Revelation. And today, when one goes to the area, there are no fires or smoke, active smoke seen to be coming from its midst. However, throughout most of the historical period, since the time of Abraham, however, it was normally described as a lake which periodically erupted with sulfurous flames and columns of smoke that could be seen emerging from its center, as we discussed earlier in the previous show. But for some reason, over the past two centuries, the lake's been quiet. Though some earthquakes have occurred in the region, which have loosed a great deal of asphalt from its bottom, which then rises and floats on top, nothing has happened that would cause any of us to call it the Lake of Fire, as most people in the past have described it, not by name, but also description.
Yeah.
But this is all going to change. The book of Revelation shows clearly that the lake of fire will be in existence at the second advent, and this is in Revelation 19, verses 19 and 20. We may not have many years left before its reactivation occurs. That an event is mentioned by the Apostle John, which could well be the catalyst that does the job. Now, when the sixth seal of the book of Revelation is opened, a most remarkable thing takes place, and this is in Revelation chapter 6, verses 12 to 14, quote, "And I beheld, when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood, and the stars fell unto the earth, even as a fig tree casts off her untimely figs, when she is shaken of a mighty wind, and the earth and the heaven departed as a scroll when it is rolled together, and every mountain and island were moved out of their place." Once again, Revelation 6, verses 12 to 14. This gigantic earthquake is associated with the time when the heavens depart as a scroll. There is only one place in all the Bible which speaks of this phenomena, and that is Isaiah chapter 34, verse 4. When it says that the streams of Edom will become burning pitch when, quote, "all the host of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled together as a scroll, and all their hosts shall fall down as the leaf falls off from the vine and as a falling fig from a fig tree. For my sword shall be bathed in heaven, and behold, it shall come down upon Edom and upon the people of my curse to judgment," end quote, Isaiah 34, 4. Now note this, all the streams of Edom flow into the Dead Sea, directly into the Dead Sea. But there is more. This is also the exact time when, quote, "the sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and terrible day of the Lord comes," according to Joel chapter 2, verse 31. Now, this is when the nations assemble in the Valley of Jehoshaphat. Joel chapter 3, verses 11 to 16 says, quote, "Assemble yourselves and come, all ye nations, and gather yourselves together round about." Then skipping forward, "Let the nations be wakened and come up to the Valley of Jehoshaphat, for there will I sit to judge all the nations round about. Multitudes and multitudes in the valley of decision. For the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and moon shall be darkened, and the stars shall cease their shining." Moving on. "And the heavens and the earth shall shake." Joel chapter 3, verses 11 to 16. At this time, at the great earthquake, when the nations are gathered in the Dead Sea area, in the valley of Jehoshaphat, southeast of the Dead Sea, or south of the Dead Sea, that is when the sun, the moon, and the stars are darkened. Now, since the streams of Edom which are in the same general region, will become burning pitch, and fire and brimstone will rain down on the heathen at the great shaking against Gog and his forces. This is in Ezekiel 38, verses 19 to 22. Some people think that the Soviet Union is going to be involved in Ezekiel 38, but this involvement occurs at the final second coming of Christ. There will be a great conflagration from heaven that will land on in the area by the Dead Sea. Christ also said there will be darkness over Jerusalem, and this is in Matthew 24, verse 29, and 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verses 7 to 8. In another place, Christ said to remember the example of Lot, Luke 17, verses 22 to 37. Now, this whole passage of Luke 17, 22 to 37, Christ starts out talking about, as in the days of Noah, there shall be marrying and giving in marriage. And then it proceeds to talk about, and likewise, as in the days of Lot. So that you've got things happening in the days of Noah, and then a separation of time, and things happening in the days of Lot. These are two separate instances of like occurrences which will occur before the second coming of Christ. Now, Lot's instance, he fled from the cities of the plain of the Jordan near the Dead Sea area in the north. That's when the whole of the Jordan Rift Valley went up in smoke. Now, Jude said that this area was an example of the future judgment that would come upon the rebellious people and nations. And this is the exact region in the Valley of Jehoshaphat, although that, in this case, that it's in the southern part of the Dead Sea area, the prophecies actually consign the entire Rift Valley east and south of Jerusalem to a fiery judgment. And throughout the region of the Jordan Rift Valley, we are told that blood will flow as high as horses' bridles. Now, as we discussed off the microphone before, this actually means that as the horses of Christ and the heavenly host ride through the valley, the splashing of the blood will go up to the bridles. It doesn't mean that it was, 4 feet seven or however tall the bridles are.
Yeah.
They're not going to be swimming in it. They're going to be splashing in it. And like a horse would do going through a stream. But that's still a lot of blood. Now, this valley, the Valley of Jehoshaphat, it says that it will go, it will be in this condition for some 1,600 furlongs, which is 1,600 stadia, about 184 miles.
Oh my gosh.
According to Revelation chapter 14, verse 20. Now, the valley in which this will happen is, quote, without the city, end quote. And the city under discussion was Mystery Babylon, meaning Jerusalem, at the end of the age. There are two Jerusalems discussed in Revelation. One is the city of Babylon in Iraq, which will be rebuilt. And then there's Mystery Babylon, which is Jerusalem at the end of the age.
Well, Saddam Hussein had started a reconstruction project of Babylon.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're still looking to do that.
Yes.
Actually, more than ever. But, nobody's going to finance anything like that unless there would be, peace.
Yeah, some stability.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, the Jordan Rift Valley from Mount Hermon to the end of the watershed south of the Dead Sea is exactly... is almost exactly 1,600 furlongs in length, as Dr. Martin writes here. This prophecy is clearly concerning the Rift Valley east of Jerusalem, the great chasm or gulf in which Sodom and Gomorrah once were, and where the parable of Lazarus and the rich man was placed. It is also where the Dead Sea is located. And since the whole of the Jordan Rift Depression went up in smoke and brimstone and fire in the time of Abraham and Lot, according to Genesis 19, verses 28 and 29, this territory will once again become the fiery crucible that it once was. In other words, you don't want to buy real estate down there.
No.
You don't want to build a house there. and don't expect to get government insurance in an area like that.
Yeah, now,
you know, if you build your house in the middle of a river, don't be surprised when it floods in the spring, you know, or in a floodplain.
That's right.
Now, Jude tells us that the first incineration was only a type, an example of the final Holocaust. Jude said, quote, likewise, which means in the same fashion, likewise will the judgment occur when the Lord comes with 10,000 of his saints, end quote. And this is Jude verse 14. It is primarily the smoke that comes from the reigniting of the Dead Sea that likely causes the sun and the moon and the stars to be darkened. This is when the Dead Sea will once again become the lake of fire that it was periodically in the time of Christ. Now, whether there probably be quite a bit of naphtha coming up, because for something to catch fire, there has to be something to burn.
Well, we've seen oil wells catch fire and the horrible smoke and stuff that comes from that. But would this be worldwide, or is this localized?
Localized to the Jerusalem area.
Okay.
Yeah. Most all prophecy is localized, unless it's specified otherwise.
Okay.
And you can actually assume that unless it's specified as being worldwide and some way, it's always localized, without exception, almost. This is when the Dead Sea will, you know, become a lake of fire that it was periodically in the time of Christ. Even the sun being darkened at the time of Christ's crucifixion was probably an eruption of the Dead Sea in Matthew 27, verse 45. And Peter must have been referring to the recent darkening of the sun and the moon when he mentioned Joel's prophecy in Acts chapter 2, verse 17 to 20 at Pentecost. Remember, you wonder, well, how can he say that this is a fulfillment of Joel's prophecy? Well, if the sun and moon was darkened at Christ, as it says in the Gospels, that would seem to Peter to be a fulfillment.
Yeah.
Well, that was just a partial fulfillment, actually, because the destructions did not actually occur. That's something else for the preterists. Those are people who believe that all the prophecies have been fulfilled before 70 AD.
Yeah, they're really whack jobs.
You said that. I didn't say that.
I'll say it again. They are. They're wacky.
But the, where was the darkening of the sun and the moon and the great destruction and the battle of Ezekiel 38 and the battle of, that proceed from Megiddo, from Armageddon?
Right.
The great armies. I mean, the armies of the Roman armies did not follow the path as described in the scriptures. They just didn't. And if you've got the book of Revelation, which is filled with over some 200 verses, which quote other passages from the Old Testament, and they just cite those passages, and you're supposed to know and understand the context, so that when you have a passage in the book of Revelation, you're supposed to understand that it's referring to a storyline encompassing 20 verses, so that, you can't. Actually, the book of Revelation is quite expansive, if you look at it in that sense. And so you can't just say, well, the book of Revelation has been fulfilled. That also means all the prophecies that are referred to in the book of Revelation that are contained in the Old Testament also have to be fulfilled.
Right.
And, if this has been the millennium till the year 1000, and we're in the Great White Throne Judgment, funny, nobody seems to be able to understand that this Kingdom of God isn't quite what everyone expected if all the prophecies have been fulfilled before 70 AD. So,
good point, David.
So even the, that darkening smoke referred to in the prophecy that had to emerge from the Valley of Jehoshaphat in the time of Christ and Peter, in the must have emerged from the Valley of Jehoshaphat in the area south of the Dead Sea. And God could have bestowed at Christ's crucifixion a foretaste of the judgment to come from the lake of fire. This all means that the Dead Sea region is once again to become, quote, the lake of fire, end quote. It will occur just before the day of the Lord when gigantic earthquakes and heavenly disturbances take place. There are yet, however, as Dr. Martin says, yet a few more years before this occurs. He has taken over 800 people on tours to the Dead Sea, and I had the opportunity to go with him and my wife and I in 1983. Goodness, that's 24 years ago. But there will come a day when the Dead Sea will erupt with a holocaust that will make Mount St. Helens of recent time seem like child's play, and it will be a spectacle to see. And thankfully, the Bible teaches that all of God's people will actually be able to escape, as Lot did, this wrath of God's vengeance to come. This is specifically stated in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 9. Now, the lake of fire is going to be healed after that time. Once Christ has returned to this earth and established his kingdom, Ezekiel says that a river of fresh water will emerge from underneath a new temple that will be built in the high country of Israel, Ezekiel chapter 47. This fresh water stream, by the way, the Ezekiel temple will not be built in Jerusalem. It will be built north of Jerusalem at Shiloh. The environs of the temple area will encompass a large portion of Jerusalem. It's going to be that big.
Wow.
This freshwater stream coming from the Ezekiel temple will go eastward into the Dead Sea, and it could well follow the old water course of the Wadi Ednar, the stream bed of fire, and change the characteristics of the land bordering it. This is no doubt what will occur, because we're told that an abundance of fruit trees and medicinal plants will flourish around its banks. This is in Ezekiel chapter 47, verse 12. This would mean that there would no longer be any Gehenna, or valley of fire, going through that terrible wilderness. In actual fact, we have the express teaching of the Bible that Gehenna, likewise called Tophet, will become holy to the Lord. Now note this scripture in Jeremiah 31, verse 40. Quote, "And the whole valley of the dead bodies and of the ashes, and all the fields into the brook of the Kidron, into the corner of the horse gate toward the east, shall be holy unto the Lord," end quote.
Okay, now if this lake of fire becomes holy to him,
mm-hmm.
Has Satan been released from it?
No, the prison will still be there,
okay.
But the abyss is different than the lake of fire.
Okay.
And it'll apparently... also pop up again at the end of the millennium. Because remember, Satan is released,
yes.
And then there's another gathering of Gog and Magog. So Gehenna will end when the whole area will be made holy unto God. With the book of Ezekiel telling us that a river of fresh water will issue forth from the new temple, which gets larger and larger as it approaches the Dead Sea. In other words, there'll be other rivers that will meet with it. Perhaps the river is fed by other streams as it descends, and this will result in parts of the wilderness of Judea being healed. And remember also that the earthquake that occurs will also level the land, this mountainous area, particularly east of the east of Jerusalem on the Mount of Olives. That whole area will be leveled for benefit to everyone. Will this whole area in the wilderness of Judea being healed, especially those quarters on the banks of the river? The region of the abyss east of Jerusalem, however, where Satan will be imprisoned, will remain in desolation, as well as parts surrounding the Dead Sea. And this is clear from Ezekiel 47, verse 11. The great quantities of fresh water flowing into the Dead Sea will cause it to become fresh and clean, and it will have a great number of fish within its borders. Ezekiel chapter 47, verse 10 says, quote, "And it shall come to pass that the fishers shall stand upon it from En-Gedi even to En-Eglaim, and there shall be a place to spread forth nets. Their fish shall be according to their kinds, as the fish of the great sea, the Mediterranean." In other words, exceeding many. It's not that they're going to be freshwater fish, or saltwater fish, that's not what it's saying. But as many as are gathered out of the Mediterranean, there will be able to be gathered in the Dead Sea, just as there is it was in the Sea of Galilee during Christ's time. That's Ezekiel 47, verse 10. Now, how long will it take for the Dead Sea to become alive is not recorded. Actually, such things can happen very quickly. A friend of Dr. Martin's, George Wesley Buchanan, actually, there are fish on the environs, on the edge of the Dead Sea, some feet into the Dead Sea that come down from the Jordan River. And those that go too far die, and those that go back live. Likewise, there are fish in the stream bed from Jerusalem to the Dead Sea that are buried, and they come out when it rains. Just like they do in the southwestern United States.
It's kind of like frogs do.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And fish do the same thing. And they'll live for decades, or I don't know if that's living, but suspended animation or whatever.
Yeah.
Since there will be a long period of time after Christ returns when peace and safety will be on the earth, and a time when many of the deserts of the earth will blossom. And it could be several years or even centuries before the whole of the Jordan Rift Valley is healed, but it will be healed and made beautiful again. But this is still not the end, however. The book of Revelation says there will be one or more outbursts of fire and brimstone that will issue from the lake. And this will happen again at the end of the millennium, and the Dead Sea will once more become a lake of fire. This will occur when God sends fire down out of heaven in Revelation chapter 20 and verse 9, to judge the wicked at the end of the 1,000 years. In other words, at the end of the millennium, there will be wicked people, but they will not be wicked because of Satan. They will have a propensity, for whatever reason, toward that time, then Satan will be loosed to mobilize them, from one way of looking at it, to gather them all together, to kill them all at once.
Oh, my gosh. Finish the job.
Now, this happens, back to the text, when Satan is finally released from the abyss, from the bottomless pit, which, remember, is different than the lake of fire,
right.
And he is allowed to cause a final rebellion to God. Dire consequences will come from God because of this, and no wonder. People on earth will have witnessed for such a long time the beauties and blessings of the kingdom of God on earth, even with Gehenna and the lake of fire healed, yet they will allow themselves to be tempted by Satan the devil. In other words, what you've got here, and because of this, God will reactivate the old area of punishment. This time, Satan, and after this war battle takes place, it's not much of a battle, but after this incident takes place, Satan will be cast into a renewed lake of fire, and this will last throughout the period of the Great White Throne. In other words, you've got to think of the periods of time when mankind will have experienced every type of life as a species, if you might say, as Adamic beings. The time before the flood, when people lived a long time, the time after the flood, to even including our present day, when people were basically living only to a time of 70 years.
Yeah.
70 years. But they had the knowledge, an increasingly growing knowledge of God during that time period. And then you have the millennium, when knowledge of God will fill the earth, and still people will rebel in every section, every time period. People will rebel so that people will understand that it doesn't matter when you would have lived, you would have been just as rebellious, so that people can't say, well, if God would have made himself evident to everybody,
yeah,
you know, Eden and the Garden of Eden were extant with cherubim out front until the flood, from Adam until the flood. They always had access to God. There's always been a witness from the time of, after the flood, from the time of Noah through Abraham, through the kingdom. Mankind has always had a witness of a chosen people. And then especially when Christ came, you even added the witness of the Gentiles, and the, you know, the righteous few, of the ecclesia. And then in the millennium, when the knowledge of God will fill the earth and people will have access, it's only now that we have it, that most people are living in ignorance of God, actually. It's, you know, after the flood to the present. Most people are not told, but the witness was always there. There was always somebody who knew the truth and was accessible. Just like today, you have the ecclesia and those who acknowledge Christ, who understand either a little or a lot that Christ is their Savior and the Messiah.
Right.
And in the millennium, that knowledge will fill the earth. And, you know, so that mankind, through all stages of God's dealing with mankind, will have no excuse. Everything will have been tried, from a king to a republic, from a democracy to a, you know, to an oppressive Pol Pot, in which it seems like the goal is to kill every human being under their governance. Or, you know, even government by corporations, which is, or government by the mafia, which is what the Soviet Union was like. And it seems to be returning to that.
Yes.
Or governance by corporations, which was what Venice was like,
yes,
during the Middle Ages, or during the Renaissance, rather. So that everything will have been tried throughout human history. Every philosophy, every sin, every government, everything will have been tried. And God will judge them all, and all will be found wanting except God's rule.
Right.
The Bible nowhere tells us how long these ages of punishment and that sort of thing within that judgment period will last. Some have applied for reference to Isaiah chapter 65, verses 17 to 24, to this space of time. Dr. Martin says this is not possible. The scene in Isaiah is millennial, and it's not applicable to a later period. It could mean that the millennium, that in the millennium, a generation could be reckoned as 100 years. If so, the millennial duration would answer to 10 generations of peace before the judgment of the end of the millennium, when Satan is released from the abyss. Now, if so, then there would have been 10 generations for the pre-flood world. Of course, those generations were a lot longer, until a destruction. Also, 10 generations until the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah in Abraham's day, and 10 generations of the millennium, which sees a fiery judgment also at its end. Now, this could mean that the ages that accompany the great white throne judgment may also last for a similar period of time. But there's also another way of looking at this, another explanation. Since the 7 days of the Feast of Tabernacles represent the millennial period of 1,000 years, and the last great day attached to that festival, which is called the Octave, answers well with the Great White Throne Judgment period, then the 1,000 years of the millennium divided by the 7 days of Tabernacles would equal about 143 years for each day. Then perhaps the Great White Throne period might equal near that same time of, near that same space of time. So I think the Great White Throne Judgment will last 1,000 years, and I don't think Dr. Martin would even bother to argue with me on that point. And we don't have time to get through it here because we have to move on. But the lake of fire will permanently cease. And when the time of the Great White Throne Judgment period is over, however long that will be after the millennium, God will then create a new heavens and a new earth in Revelation chapter 21, verse 1. And all of the former things, including the lake of fire, will pass away. And this is in Revelation 21, verses 4 and 5.
Does that include the FDA, too, I hope? I'm serious.
Yes.
I'm very serious.
Probably long before that.
Oh, good.
They'll be gone.
Good.
It says, quote, "Behold, I make all things new." And this is in Revelation 21, verse 5. And this is when God the Father himself finally comes to this earth to establish his residence here. That's in the New Jerusalem, in Revelation chapter 21, verses 2 and 3. God himself will leave heaven and come to earth. There will be a New Jerusalem totally unlike any that preceded it. There will be no need for any earthly temple, Revelation 21, verse 22. But there will be a river of water that comes forth from the throne of God. This is in Revelation 22, verses 1 and 2.
Yes.
The physical example of water coming from the Shekinah, which is the cloud of sapphire throne that gave water to the children of Israel in the wilderness for 40 years, and the temple that existed in Ezekiel's prophecy that will exist during the millennium, the millennial temple, with water flowing from it, will both serve as a foretaste to this new water source in the new earth. There will even be nations that God will allow to be on the earth at that time. This is in Revelation 21, verses 24 to 26, and Revelation 22, verses 2 to 5. This means that there will be a new creation of humans, because all the humans who will have lived from the time of Adam to the end of the Great White Throne will now be spiritual beings. This is 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 4 to 6. This new creation of humans could very well be a hint that God has further creations of human beings in mind, both for this earth and in other regions of the universe, because the heavens were designed to receive inhabitants. This is in Deuteronomy chapter 30. Verse 4.
Now,
and of course, there'll be a new heavens as well as a new earth.
When these new human beings, for lack of a better term, there's also the people who received the spiritualized body or the glorified body from the first resurrection, right?
Right.
Okay. So we have two different groups here.
Right.
Okay.
Well, there's three resurrections of human beings of Adam. And Dr. Martin uses the term humans. We don't know what they'll be. But it does talk about nations. I'd have to look at Revelation 21, 24 to 26, and 22, verses 2 to 5, to see if anthropos, if the common word, you know, anthropos is used there. If that's the case in Revelation, in those passages, then indeed we're talking about people like you and me.
Yeah.
You know, human flesh and bone and blood. In other words, God will start over.
Mm-hmm.
And since the prime characteristic that described God is his role as creator, and this is in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, and it could be that this creation of new sons and daughters will continue throughout all eternity. Who knows? But you'll notice it's not like you and me creating them, I've never read Mormon theology. It's not you and me creating them. It's God starting over apparently. We'll already be sons and daughters of God. We could no doubt, however, play a part in helping God with this continued creation. After all, we are his children, and we will not only see him as he is, but we shall be exactly like he is and this is stated in 1 John chapter 3, verse 2, you, Georgianne, and me will be able to look at God the Father in the face, eye to eye, someday. Our present human race has a destiny that's just unbelievably awesome in potential and glorious in scope.
Absolutely.
And we haven't even begun to see what God has in store for us, as it says in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 9.
Right.
Eye has not seen nor ear heard, neither has entered into the heart of man the things that God has prepared for them that love him. End quote.
Yes.
1 Corinthians 2, 9. The time is coming when death will be abolished for all who have ever lived, according to 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 26. The final conclusion of all things is that God will become all in all, 1 Corinthians 15, verse 28. There will be no more Gehenna, no more abyss, no more Dead Sea, no more lake of fire. All that will be left is life and the beginning of a series of new creations in which all of us will participate for the rest of eternity that lies ahead of us. That's going to be fun.
Yes, exciting. You know, we're not given every detail.
No, we're not.
You know, I mean, God has given us a really nice snapshot of what he's going to do, but he hasn't disclosed in minute detail every little thing.
No, he hasn't.
Yeah. Oh, this is so good. Very stimulating, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Wow.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, well, thank you for putting up with me. I can be a little testy, I've been told. Go to askelm.com. You can read this book, 101 Bible Secrets, for free. Online at askelm.com. You can email David Seeloff at this address, david@askelm.com. And this ends file number 22B. And we will continue as soon as possible with file number 23, which is the population of the Exodus. So we look forward to that.
Right, and then we'll probably do 6 and 7 at the same time and put the cap on the book.
Okay.
And 7 is the secret of the number 666.
Uh-huh.
So
Okay. We'll
do both at the same time. They're fairly short.
Okay.
So, sounds good.
And then maybe we can get into that the mystery.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be very interesting, what God has planned. Very intriguing. And faith building, too.
Yeah.
Well, David, thank you so much. God bless you. And God bless everybody out there listening. This is Georgianne Hughes with David Seeloff signing off. We will be back. Good night, everybody.